welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. Today we're going to hear readings from Etkin and from Eric Schlick.
And before we start, we just have a few reminders. Please silence your cell phones. Also, please don't smoke in the warehouse. And try not to get up while our readers are reading. We'll have a break between readers where you can take care of whatever needs you need to take care of. And right now we have Amy Denham introducing our first reader.
Is it good? Do we think it's going to fall? Okay. Hello, everyone. So I have the honor tonight of introducing Eric Schlick. This is a writer I've known since the fall of 2010, when he and I, two recent college grads from rival schools in Kentucky, entered the MFA program in fiction at Bowling Green State, nestled in the frigid wasteland just south of Toledo, affectionately known as the armpit of Ohio. Not knowing at all what we were getting ourselves into, I will now begin a series of jokes that only Eric, his lovely wife Jade, a fellow BG alum, and myself will get. These things would turn out to include a composition program led by a startlingly Umbridgian leader, bizarre outdoor malls with aspirationally fancy names like Levis Commons and Fallen Timbers, and within a semester, both of our first brushes with recreational drugs. There were, however, also really good radio stations in Northwest Ohio, one of the most pedestrian-friendly towns I've ever lived in, beautiful in the fall, and some incredibly talented, supportive faculty who helped shape us into the writers we are today. Let me be clear, Eric was in a league of his own, offering up, right from the start, glimpses into his already sophisticated literary universe. This was a psychologically, morally, and in the case of an especially memorable take he wrote on the character of Merlin, physically complex world, merging the comic with the tragic. In the many, many stories I've read by Eric in our two grad programs together, I've never seen his writing drift into the realm of weepy, sentimental self-indulgence so many writers find ourselves falling into. As Tara Eason wrote in his Hayden's Ferry Review award-winning flash fiction piece, When You Are Old and I Am Gray, it's, quote, it's difficult to avoid cliche or sentimentality when writing about the most universal experiences, love, death, illness, but Schlick's jewel of a story reveals the profound and the most mundane details of life. T.C. Boyle echoed this in his review of Eric's Stella Kupferberg Memorial Prize award-winning short story, Head Over Heels, saying that it stood as the very model of what a short story can achieve, opening up to the kind of richness and depth one might expect from a much longer piece. Also immediately refreshing was Eric's disinclination towards snobbery, his characters often not turning up their noses, but rather finding themselves bewitched by the pop culture around them. Some of the most memorable pieces I've read by Eric have explored the fallout of extreme fandom, of a little boy obsessed with ruby slippers, of masses of people, past and present, caught up in a twisted fetishization of the Titanic sinking. Eric's fiction is able to brilliantly evoke the relationship between fantasy and depravity, between the personal and the profound. Eric's stories have appeared or are forthcoming in Hayden's Ferry Review, Nimrod, Redivider, Electric Literature, Jabberwock Review, and The New South. And I believe the story he's reading for us tonight is something new. Everyone, please help me welcome Eric Schlick.
I'm a little taller than Amy. Thank you so much, Amy. That was really great to have some Bowling Green flashbacks in that intro. Thanks to Matt and Whitney also for hosting this. I really appreciate the opportunity to read. So a little preface to the story I'm going to read tonight. A year ago, I taught a class about time travel novels. We read a lot of fun novels in that class. We read A Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. We read The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. We read Kindred by Octavia Butler. A lot of fun time travel books. I love time travel. I do have to say that this story does not quite have time travel in it. so sorry to disappoint. but it's inspired by my favorite part of time travel narratives, which is when a self meets another version of themselves. So whether that's in Back to the Future, or that's in the Audrey Niffenegger book, or in Charles Yu's How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, It has to do with the self, meaning the same version or a multiple version of themselves. So this story is called Quantum Convention. In the Marriott ballroom, 100 of me have gathered. I thought it was going to feel like a fun house, you know, with the mirrors. But it's nothing like a fun house. It's more like a family reunion, except you don't know anyone and it's all cousins. Fat me is in the corner with a plate of kale chips. Every so often, he shoots a glance at the spread of donuts, bagels, and cheese cubes. Across from him sits mustache me. I'm tempted to say pedophile me. Jane's right, I can't pull off facial hair without looking like a creep. Goatee me, better, not great, is chatting with fashion disaster me, who wears a neon orange jumpsuit. He's not the only one in an outfit. There's prom date me in a tux, hobo me in a gray toboggan, and drag queen me in a blonde wig. Hey, sad eyes. It takes a second to realize he means me. It's mullet me waving me over to a table filled with more of me. I say, hi, I'm Colin, and they all bust a gut. Oh, right, I guess you knew that. Hi, Colin, I'm Colin, says suit me. Oh, wow, I'm Colin too, says aftershave me. Guys, this is uncanny, says sarcastic me. We really should get name tags. First time, says suit. Didn't mean to give myself away. You can always tell, says mullet. Then comes the expected opener. What do you do? I think about bending the truth, saying I teach at a liberal arts college instead of at a public high school, but I opt for honesty, hoping they will too. I wait for the inevitable those who can't joke, but it doesn't come. I guess I hate that joke in every uni. No shit, says aftershave. Me too, what subject? English. Ouch, he says. All those essays, should have switched to math. Numbers, man, practically teaches itself. Funny, that's what Mr. Farquaad told me. Hey, the table cheers. Fork point. A fork point, mullet explains, is the moment one self splits into two. You know, like two roads diverge in the woods and all that. One self walks down one road, one walks down the other. Except it's more like two roads and then two more roads and then two more, until you have an infinite number of selves, only some of whom attend quantum. Remember that day in the hall, aftershave says? Weird, I do remember. One day, when I was student teaching, I was walking down the hall with three folders of essays on Lord of the Flies. I turned a corner and ran smack into Mr. Farquaad. Calculus quizzes and book reports went flying. As we picked them up, Farquaad told me he didn't envy my grading. He had a point. Both my parents were high school teachers. My mother, English, my father, history. They used to come home with stacks of student essays. Sometimes they'd take sick days just to catch up on the grading. I used to swear I'd never turn into them. But math? Math seemed so sterile. There was no magic in it. You couldn't cut the head off a Beanie Baby named Squealer, stick it on the end of a broomstick, and bring it into your class as a prop. Or pose important, unanswerable questions such as, is man good or evil, after Roger smashes Piggy's head in with a rock? The rest of the table shares what they do. Mullet runs a dog kennel, Suit's a writer, Sarcasm a college adjunct. When Sarcasm talks about his job, contract exploitation, no benefits, food stamps, I consider changing his name to Bitter Me. He's the grad school version of myself. So glad I didn't get stuck there. I could see myself in Suit, aftershave, or Sarcasm, but mullet? I remember joking once to Jane about quitting my job and doing something that required zero mental energy, like opening a dog kennel, but I wasn't serious. Suit's the one I'm most interested in, the better version of me. I've written three screenplays, drawered in my desk at home. One about a sensitive, white, middle-class man stuck in a loveless marriage. One about a sensitive, white, middle-class man stuck in a dead-end career. And one about zombies. What do you write, I ask. I'm a ghost writer, he says. I just wrote Justin Bieber's memoir. Oh, God. Suit shrugs. That shit sells. Yeah, but are you fulfilled? Everyone at the table looks at me. A beat. It's awkward. Then they all crack up. Aftershave laughs so hard he spills his beer. Mullet slaps me on the back. I don't see what's so funny. The reason I came to Quantum is simple. I want to find perfect me. Jane is skeptical about perfect me. She thinks he's like Bigfoot, a myth. I mostly agree with her. Except when you think about it, there are an infinite number of unis in the multiverse, which means an infinite number of me. And somewhere in that infinity, there's a me who made a right choice, and then another, and then another. Only 15 minutes at Quantum, and I'm beginning to suspect perfect me might be more difficult to find than I'd originally thought. I'd settle for happy me. So yeah, fulfilled. How much they paying you? Sarcasm says. What? The multiverse census. Mullet snorts beer through his nose. It's like lunch duty in here. I don't get you guys. I say, isn't this what Quantum's all about? To get to know your alt selves and become better people? Someone drank the Kool-Aid, Sarcasm says. That's how they sell it, Aftershave says. You think if any of us were fulfilled, we'd be at Quantum, Suit says. What do you mean? Look around, sad eyes. You see any well-adjusted selves at this table? Colin here is a serial cheater. He's divorced 4 times. Then you got Colin, who won't have his student loans paid off until he's 80. And behind door number 3, there's Colin, who literally picks up shit for a living. Jesus. This was not what I had in mind when I clicked on that pop-up ad. This sad room full of me nursing their drinks, trading miseries? Are any of you happy, I ask? Suit snorts. Sarcasm rolls his eyes. Aftershave chugs the rest of his beer. Surprisingly, Mullet nods. Mostly. Then again, it's like Colin said, I spend most of my day picking up shit. Then why do any of you come here? Suit shrugs. To drink. To keep ourselves company, says Sarcasm, the wit. To swap stories, measure dicks, says Aftershave. Plus, Mullet leans in, there's a raffle later on. God, is that what my laugh sounds like? I can't help wondering as their guffaws chase me out to the hall. I'm trying to find my way to the lobby, then back to my home uni, but somehow I get turned around. All the conference rooms look the same, and I come around one corner too fast and slam right into a woman hurrying in the opposite direction. When I go to help her up, I see it's my wife. Jane, what are you doing here? And it topples down on me. She must have known I'd lied and followed me. Oh, honey, I say, I'm sorry. I know you said this wasn't a good idea, and you were right, but I was stubborn and stupid, and I had to see for myself. Can we please just go home and pretend this never happened? Jane frowns and looks at me funny. Her hair is different. Jane is always changing her hair. When she's stressed, she pops to her hairdresser and comes back with a different dye. Hot toffee, copper shimmer, sunflower blonde. When she does something drastic, like a bob or a perm, I give her space. Now her hair is pulled back in a ponytail, only shorter, less pony, more rabbit. It's darker, too, a deeper shade of brunette than I'm used to, near black, with a tinge of purple. Blowout burgundy? Did you go to the salon, I ask? How much? But I stop myself. Our last few arguments have all been about money. Jane says she's beginning to feel like she lives in a Gestapo state run by our checkbook. And I don't really have a leg to stand on with my most recent purchase. When I showed her the QC website, she said it was too expensive. I'd already bought a ticket. Jane shakes her head and makes a tisk tisk noise I've never heard before. I'm sorry, she says. Do I know you? I don't know whether to laugh or not. I settle for a dry chuckle. Well, I'm only your husband. I've never seen you before in my life. What did you say your name was? What is this, role play? Is that what we're doing? Jane and I tried role play once. We played sexy maid fucked by hot plumber. It was a disaster. She kept breaking the fourth wall to get the story straight. So the Grishams are out strolling in the countryside when you come to fix the sink. The Grishams? Yeah, they're the family that owns Billings Manor. Have you been binging Downton again? No self-respecting woman would wear this in present day, Colin. Wait, did they have plumbers back then? Maybe you could be an underbutler. Do you have long underwear? I think you could just be dusting, and I'd, you know, take you from behind. Dusting, Jane laughed. Rosalie's a lady's maid, Colin, not a kitchen wench. When Jane sets her mind on something, she goes all in, which is why I'm not surprised she'd pretend to not know me to punish me for lying to her and attending Quantum. I don't realize I've taken her arm until she snatches it away. Jane, I reach for her, and she says, touch me again, and I'll scream. She turns and rushes back down the hotel hall. I follow, and she breaks into a full sprint. I feel like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, the scene when George Bailey chases after his wife, Mary, a spinster librarian, and the alt uni in which he was never born. Jane, it's me, Colin. Come on, we've been married for 10 years. She slips into a conference room. I go in after her, and suddenly I've stumbled not on one alt uni, but a room full of them. 100 Janes look up at me from their punch glasses, pause on the dance floor, break conversation to gape at me. Get away from me, rabbit-tailed Jane shouts. She falls back dramatically in a faint. Two other Janes catch her. I survey the room, a kaleidoscope of my wife's face on woman after woman. You need to leave, says bodybuilder Jane. This is a safe space, says cowgirl Jane. No men. I'm sorry, it's just, is my wife here? Several other Janes come forward. Colin, darling, says Stepford Jane, touching her pearls. What are you doing here? You're embarrassing me in front of my friends. Who's watching the kids, says Mom Jane and her mom jeans and her mom cardigan, which is disturbing because we don't have any children. What the heck, Colin? My Jane, or one who looks suspiciously like her, comes barreling through the crowd. I'm sorry, she says to the other Janes, looping her arm through mine. I'll deal with him. Out in the hall, she drops my arm and digs around in her purse. Thank God, she says. It's Snoozeville in there. Jane, I examine her. The hair's close enough, same fashion sense, same smile. Yeah, she says. No, I mean, are you my Jane? You tell me. She surfaces from her purse with a pack of Nicorette gum. My Jane doesn't smoke. She holds up the gun. Neither do I. I ask her if she knows the way back to the lobby, and she leads me down the hall to an elevator. Coming, she holds the door for me. I think it's on this floor. She smacks her gum furiously. I step in. It opens on a hotel bar and restaurant. Alt Jane sallies out. The least you can do is buy me a drink. I know, she sips her cocktail. Ask me something only she'd know the answer to. I don't think that works here, I say. Why not? Well, I set down my beer. When you think about it, there could be a Jane here who's exactly like my wife, only, I don't know, she didn't brush her teeth this morning. If that's all that separates me from your wife, we're practically the same person. Practically, not actually. Alt Jane laughs, and it's like time slips. She has better oral hygiene. You laugh like her, my wife, or how she used to. How does she laugh now? I don't know, less full? She used to throw her head back like you do. Wow, you are just like my Colin. How so? She shrugs. Devil's in the details. So we sit and drink. I'm about ready to take the elevator down, find the lobby, and go home to my Jane, when Alt Jane says, I know, let's play a game. I'm not in the mood for games. Oh, come on, it'll be fun. It's called Never Ever. I'll be your Jane and you'll be my Colin. We have to tell each other something we'd never, ever tell our spouses. I don't know. I'll go first. She twirls the miniature umbrella in her drink. Okay, Colin, my sweet Colin. Never, ever have I told you that I wished I'd married a man with a real job. You know, a career, a doctor or a lawyer, a businessman, a guy in a suit. Not a wannabe artist who basically babysits other people's kids and makes no money. Hey. She chortles and claps. Boy, that felt good. I've been holding on to that for a while. Okay, your turn. I don't like this game. I move to get out of the booth. Oh, come on, I did it. I'm sorry, I don't know what to say. "Look at me," she says. "So I do." Her cheeks are flush pink from the alcohol. She has on a bright turquoise necklace like the one my Jane wears. "Don't I look like her?" "Well, yeah." "Okay, then tell me. You have carte blanche here. Say what you've always wanted to say to her. I won't get mad." I try to think of something harmless, a throwaway. Sometimes I look at other women. "That's it? Everyone does it. I bet you'd even tell her that. Come on, Colin, don't you have something you'd like to get off your chest?" "I've never cheated on her, if that's what you're getting at." "Oh, Colin, I'm disappointed. I thought you'd have something better than that." "Okay, how's this? Hi, Jane. Guess what? I used the money you were saving for our second round of IVF to pay for this." "For what?" "The stupid doppelganger convention." Others in the restaurant glance our way. I sink down in the booth. Alt Jane leans forward over the candle on the table. Shadows dance across her face. "Oh, that's good," she said. "That's really good. Won't she find out?" I told her it was for car repairs, parked the car at the mall for a few days, took an Uber to work. "That's so messed up. That's some serious deceit. I wonder if I can top it." She mulls it over, signaling for the waiter to bring us another round. "Okay, I got it." She reaches forward and takes my hand. "Colin, love, never ever have I told you that I fantasize about Coach Farley when we're in the sack." "Ugh," I take my hand back. "Are you serious? Matt Farley, that Neanderthal?" "Sure." "I bet he has back hair. My Jane thinks back hair is about the grossest thing a man can have. She told me this in bed, trailing her hand down my spine after I'd said I'd wished I had more chest hair. "Sometimes it's a turn-on," Alt Jane says. "And no one says in the sack anymore. I say in the sack. My Jane would never say in the sack." "Well, I'm not your Jane." Our drinks come, a welcome distraction. I take a swig after this one. I'm out of here. "Matt Farley? I still can't believe it. What a tool." "It's your turn," she reminds me. I don't know if it's the $8 beer or the idea of my sad, schlockered selves getting more and more shit-faced together, floors below us, or if I really want to shock her on it. If suddenly I've lost my grip and she is my Jane, that I finally come right out with it. "All right, here it is, Jane. How's it go? Oh, right. Never, ever have I told you. I don't want kids. Not through all the sperm tests and needle sticks. Not once did I bring it up. How after every pregnancy test, I prayed it would come back negative. How when you cried and I held you, all I felt was relief. Thank God, I thought, another day for my life to be my own. But what life is that? Every day I drive to school, I think of getting on the expressway and driving west and west and west until there's no more west. There's just water. I'd move to California, work on my screenplays, peddle them on the street, bartend or wait tables to make rent. You think I don't know I'd be miserable? That a week in that life and I'd miss you terribly? Then why can't I stop thinking about it? While you're sobbing over a pair of baby Reeboks in Shoe Carnival, I'm blocking the goddamn scene in my head for a black comedy on suburban discontent. Every day I resent you for wanting more than me, even while I'm wanting more than you too. How sick is that? You're the only goddamn thing I did right in my life, you. So if I can't figure out how to be happy with you, and I can't on my own, how the fuck am I supposed to do it with a child? Alt Jane's eyes widen. I know I'm making a spectacle of myself, but I can't stop. The other conference goers shift their attention toward us. And when I stand to leave, I see that they're all Janes and Collins, each couple at a table with a little candle, a cocktail, and a beer. Maybe they're married, attending Quantum together, but I doubt it. I bet each are from a different uni, mixed and matched, all of them having conversations like Alt Jane's and mine, comparing relationships, taking notes. You're not a special little snowflake. There are billions of snowflakes out there that are just like you. You couldn't be more insignificant. Maybe later they'll end up in hotel rooms together. Maybe they'll recognize their spouses in the familiar ways they are touched. Or maybe there will be just enough variation for it to be new, like when you and your wife come back to each other after so long apart, and you think, who are you? Where have you been all my life? Here, she tells you, right here, all your life beside you, and you sigh in her arms, oh, how I've missed you. I take the elevator down and wander the halls until I find the lobby. When I check out, the concierge gives me a complimentary swag bag with the QC logo. I tell him I don't want it. But it's free! He slides my black key card across the counter. I take the card and leave the bag. I swipe the key in the exit door and step through from the Marriott lobby to the Days Inn lobby in my home uni. I head out through the sliding doors to the parking lot. Before I can get to my car, my phone alerts me with a chain of texts and voicemails, all from Jane. I rush home, knowing but not knowing, and when I walk in, she's in the kitchen, and the way she rests her palm flat on her stomach, I know. I know, and when she asks me where the hell I've been, before she can even give me the news, I tell her how happy I am. Thank you.
Up next, to introduce Etkin is Sindhu.
I am honored to introduce Etkin. I met Etkin 2 years ago at the orientation for incoming PhD students. We started this program together, and in the last 2 years, we've taken 5 fiction workshops together, which is more than I've ever taken with anyone. And those 5 include a novel workshop and a short story collection workshop. So by my estimation, I've read enough of Etkin's work to fill 3 books, and I can't wait to read more. I'm a reader who loves voice, and Etkin's is one of the most unique I've ever heard. It's a voice that seduces you into a hypnotic trance so that you don't expect the gut-wrenching turns. The sparseness of Etkin's prose hides the damage that her words do to you until it's too late. If you read between the letters, if you take the time to pry them apart, you'll find deep pain stitched into the back of every word. Etkin's characters live in a surreal, lavish world of jet-setting vacations and high fashion, designer drugs, and elite opulence. But it's a world that has a dangerous and malevolent underbelly. Affluence has turned sour on these characters' tongues. They yearn deeply for their emotions, their drive, their senses of self, all numbed and forgotten long ago in the shadow of luxury. Etkin navigates this opulent world with dexterity and compassion. Through the numbness of her characters, we readers are left reeling. Etkin is a master of the short form. She condenses her stories into little neutron stars, little balls of unbelievable mass and power. Against this gravity, her characters struggle to keep themselves from unraveling, creating tension at a molecular level. In workshop, Etkin doesn't shy away from the difficult discussions. She's often the first to point out politically grating moments in other people's work, encouraging us all to do better, to be better. She draws from her own history and experience as a Turkish-American woman in order to meet the world with sharp political consciousness and compassion for the fringe experience. Etkin Kamoglu is a Turkish-American writer born in Arizona and raised in New York City. She's a doctoral student at Florida State University, where she teaches while at work on her novel, Turklish, which I've read a part of and is fantastic. She earned her BA from New York University and her MFA from the University of Colorado Boulder. Ms. Etkin's most recent work is featured in the latest issues of Sonora Review and Quarterly West. She's a 2016 Lorraine Hemingway Short Story Prize top finalist. Please help me in welcoming Etkin.
Thank you, Sindhu. That was lovely. I hope I can live up to it. And thank you, everyone, for being here. And thank you to our lovely hosts. I'm going to read 3 short shorts about New York. They all sort of are meant to go together. So the first one is called What Fine Souls You Got. What fine souls you got. One swelterous summer evening, Mode and I go downtown. I ride the last car, get off on 68th. She meets me on the platform and we get back on. No definite agenda or place, though we'll meet a couple boys. That's the plan. First things first, Mode describes her most recent escapade. There are not too many people on board. This about that time when folk flee away on the jitney, which is what we did too over the 4th, got stuck in traffic, wasted away an afternoon in an empty house in the middle of woods with the good-for-nothing United Nations, then bartered our faces for a place to stay on the beach, a friend of a boy of a boyfriend. But that's another thing. This thing here is Mode miming how she pulls strings or some such nonsense. She likes a good show. A scumbag stands in front of us like he doesn't know how to do empty 6th train seats, prefers to have his pelvis aired out by the fresh breath of 2 girls. Well, Mode pulls her imaginary strings, teaching me a much needed lesson, she thinks, because I don't do that dirt easy breezy. The scum goes all awry with each tug of Mode's fine fingers. Mode, please, look, I say, bury my head. So who? Mode pretends deaf or what not and continues on her demonstration. The United Nations tells us that Mode and I, we've got a reputation. Those won't go east of Lexington, girls. So Mode is on a mission, though I stand by my title with a certain pride. Okay, Mode, point proven. Scum scurries off in 42nd to find a perfect point of semi-public release. Mode and I exit on Spring, a good spot to wander a vaporous night. The Soho crowds of Japanese bin shoppers and mannequin people, none of that tasteless pastel Scottish terrier print salmon pink down here. AC units spit out on sidewalk cafes sipping rosé. We plan to take part, show our mark. How do we end up on East Houston? I don't know, we walk. Not exactly the posh mosh we aim for, but oh well. We happen in a place with a DJ and turntable and white couches and white tables, and the music's what's called lounge, like soul but spoken in a backtrack of a video game tune warped. What do we order? Soco lime, because the color is cute but hits our head right quick, the goal to be good silly. 2 mechs with baller lookbooks sit at the only other occupied spot. 2 who nurse white wine. They eyeball us, but not for much. Ladies, you best watch yourselves, one suddenly shouts at us across the way. Why's that? Mode yells back with a swish of hair. Another goal of hers is to be the good flirt, but she is right now a novice. You best take care of one another, says the one who speaks. He's serious. The other busy with texts. We do, says Mode, because we do. No white lie. The last of our green jolly drink gone, we suck straws at residue. They best get us around, I say to Mode. The volume on the lounge goes up 3 notches. No one else ever enters. Where you lovely ones come from, number one comes over, slides next to me on our white couch. From here, says Mode, continues to suck. Let me guess, Texas, he says. Yeah, name's Dallas, I say. Pleased to meet you, Dallas, name's Freedom. We shake hands. Hey man, this girl here thinks she's from Texas. Number two salutes and disappears. He's to go see his honey, says Freedom. Oh sure, we know, says Mode. I need another and say and start back on straw to match Mode. I'm on you. Freedom holds up 2 fingers to the waitress who picks her nails behind the neon-lit bar. And then he points to my foot, and we all look down. Mode, Freedom, and I. We stare at my foot. I've donned tan patent lather strappy heels, peep toe, crisscross cross across ankle. Do a turn, Freedom says. And all of a sudden, the lounge gets under me. I can pretend. No Madison Avenue here. Girls have got to be part mannequin. Mode and I walk out to the DJ in unison, stop, do our best pucker jut, walk back to our white altitude. Freedom takes my arch, traces the under part with a lick of night, and the city outside melts into juice. Okay, this second one is titled Prophet, aka Egg. The Prophet, aka the Egg, sees me out one night in meatpacking back when that was still hot. I march in line with a couple models, one being a fine male specimen who picked me up at one of those jigs thrown by the Afghan prince. My dear, calls out Prophet, aka Egg, is that you? Can that be you? Hell yeah, this be me, I don't say. I stop to kiss him two cheeks. He's got on a class act mohair coat that goes down to his boat shoes and his hair is down to his ever-long eyelashes. I've just come back to the city from a three-month gig in the mountains where each and every morning I do two rounds on the cross-country circuit at the frozen golf course, and afternoons I snowshoe up to the midway point of a western rocky peak. So at this point present, I've lost a good 10 pounds since last he saw me, which was Istanbul, where 6 months of low-level work lent me many the idle afternoon to gorge on spinach cheese pies and fistfuls of frothy yogurt. But now I look refined, and the Prophet, or the Egg, this he sees. Can I call you, he says. Can I get your number here? Prophet opens up his phone and takes me down. Yes, last I hear he's gone for an exchange spot on a New York firm. No harm in that. This boy I can see. This boy, I've known him longer than any Turk no one can name, yes, sir. Egg invites me over to Murray Hill for homespun breakfast the next Sunday. I take a cab down. This is right when the medallions switch from cash only to credit swipers. I hail a cabbie on Park and zoom we go down through the MetLife. The meter stops right at 33rd. Taxi man turns to me and says, cash only. But you've got a machine here, I say. No, he says. No cash, I say. He points to a bodega on the corner with the ATM sign. Credit card only, I say. Open the door. I'm sorry. Whore, he says. You prostitute. I slam, walk my high boots off. Not my fault if I look good. Lace black stockings, wool tunic, brown bomber, maroon cashmere scarf that surrounds, hangs down to my upper thighs on one end in the back, big hoops, the Jackie O dark shades, bright apricot matte mouth, manicure to match, and Chloe cologne, a floral sour scent, the best kind. Well, Prophet, aka Egg, cooks, tells me his parents have just been in town and that they brought him goods from Istanbul, pastirma, kaimak, and simit rounds. Though not fresh from the street cart, of course, but still good for kicks. And bonus point, there's a Turk mart, he says, just down the block on 2nd. From there, he boasts green sour plums that we dip in salt. Prophet scrambles a few eggs, tells me I'm too skinny. Spoon feeds me kaimak once or twice, doused in honey. And then he puts on his big screen to mute European soccer. No, football, English league. I don't ask him about Besiktas or his home team, or is it Galatasaray he roots for? Which players is it gets nabbed for the Italians and French? Then Egg puts on his computer and turns on music. First up, Belgian dance pop, Alors on danse. Then Egg Prophet stands up in his bathrobe. Yes, he wears a bathrobe tied loosely to show off his chest and his checkered American boxers. He takes my hands, pulls me off the couch, and turns me around so that his arms wrap around me. So why is he called the Egg? Because in English, this sounds like his name, simple like that. Though really, his name refers to a famous waterway known for Greek and Roman lores of yore. And why the Prophet? Because he tells me so a long time ago, many, many serious moons ago. back in high school, back when I go for the first time to study over the summer, in Istanbul, that is. The night when we let the rest go to the dance and stay in the dorm and lay out on the roof, drink from a bottle of cheap cherry wine, feel the breeze from the Bosphorus come our way, and listen to the beat from the clubs down below and the last call from the mosque with the yellow walls that stands outside our courtyard. But no, that's too far away now, because now in New York, in his apartment on 33rd, he holds me against him tight. We watch the windows of a high rise across the way, all blinds drawn, not one stray. That boy you were last night? Prophet Egg asks. I know the guy from Yale. Always he has strange girls with him, always different girls. And so I know that in this way he thinks more of me, more a girl of New York and not anymore a low-level Turk whose father came with little to America because he was of no import, because he was köylü, a peasant, which is how the egg thinks of me before. But now I see, I feel that I am more for him. And you know, you're smarter than me, the prophet says, his fingers slipped within me and his hot, hungry breath inside of me. Okay, and the last one is titled The Apollo Circle. This one's up at Quarterly West, if you want to read it. The Apollo Circle. The type at the MoMA approaches you and me first thing when we walk in. Look, a swan, he says, isn't she just divine? Presumably, he talks about me, personally offers us flutes of champagne. This guy has a spray tan, very white teeth, bleached buzz. Where is such a good-looking couple headed, may I ask? Buzz says. The Egyptian gala at the Met, you blurt, because he needs to know, because you can't resist your inane, infantile urge to show off to this aged Floridian leech. Buzz enjoys you, takes you in, and then you are usurped. Before I can say cheese, you've been taken under his wing. I'm relegated to the side. Buzz makes you pose with him for the society pics. But this was supposed to be our photo shoot. This was supposed to be our pre-party gig. Gulp, gulp, comp cocktails, pick up pop rock popcorn, hop outside to pose by Giacometti bronze stick figures, gaze up in love at the 52nd Street sky. But no, you go get carried away by accolades, forget all about me. Me, your ticket in, me, your so-called girl, ha. I stir him off up the stairs to the second level where a giant crystal octopus blown by industrial fans elusively gyrates. Bravo to this artist, she's got balls, forget about Picasso. And then I feel your slime sweated hand on my low back. Please don't be mad, you whine, have I been bad? Aren't I divine, I say, don't turn around. Walk to the other side of the eight legs, realize they are not crystal, but some sort of morphable plexi. You follow me and put your lips on my shoulder, scrunch into me so that my so-called swan dress poofs down. Get off, you cramp my style, I say, walk back to the other side. Why don't you go off with your boyfriends? Please don't, you say, trail me, you sunken puppy. I wish the pod would zap you against the wall, flat pancake. You take my hair to your face, make stupid sounds. You and your ego can't ever resist flattery. You like to believe you are likable. Who would ever hate you? My fault for not grabbing you out of testosterone tentacles. Two more glasses and off the gala that overlooks the illuminated Odalisque. Jackie O's, did you know that penthouse over yonder? Direct views, I lose my red leather gloves. From Saks, I lose my Swarovski hairpin because I take mitts off, let dude down. And in the morning, you're a downright skunk. The bottle of anise you bought last night, you've done a good number off, finished a solid three quarters. The sun in full bloom streams through my room. 93rd Street in gardenia bloom. The bedroom of the little boy in the brownstone next door ready for the day. Toy soldiers lined atop his desk, a whole regiment ready to attack. My girl's hotter than any of those 1% hoes, you say, lean me against the windowsill, trace my backbones with your tongue like a cat, coarse, dry, over each and every vertebrae. Let me play with you, please. Don't mind, dear, do you? You say. How forward you are. Now you're a man. You rub yourself against me from behind, and the more you do this, the more your touch becomes you. But you're filthy, square, sad slop. Why now have you chosen to turn on? But I oblige, kill time. Next thing we're on the couch, and I straddle you, and you let my slip fall off my shoulders and feel my breasts, and I look outside at the buildings across the way. Can we be seen? If a person peers out and about and focuses right upon my window, would he wonder? Why does she let her hair drop in front of her face and lean forward, only to moments later throw herself back? Said spectator would understand implications. You rub my thighs and tell me how much you want me, make me turn around, nozzle down inside of me. Organic strawberries, you say. I think of the little fuzzy white hairs all around my upper legs and how the tendrils must be illuminated from the light. I trust you are too gone to note. Your vision blurred, the world a pleasant trip. Though we do get a picture last night of us on my phone, gloves on, pin on, you kiss me. Favorite pose of yours to show off your Gretchen nose and fire red mane. Hand tight completely around the circumference of my forearm. Almost a perfect fit. Yes, see, there's this. How at least I fit your grasp. That's all. Thank you.
Let's hear it one more time for Etkin. And if you could do the bartender a favor and bus your bottles and glasses, we'd appreciate it.
And come back next week for Deborah Monroe. Thank you, guys.